real wisdom be found? And then he answers his own question. He talks about how valuable it is. It can't be purchased. Humans don't even really truly appreciate or know its true value. In verse 23, he says, but God understands the way to wisdom. You might want to write in your margins. I did. You don't have to. I won't check. Colossians 2:3, one of my favorite verses about Jesus. It says, in Jesus are stored up and hidden all of the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. In Jesus. You get Jesus, you get it all. And that is without Jesus being by name in the picture. That is what Job is saying in verses 23 through verses 28. Other key words in this, down in verse 28, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And he's saying that's what God says. And we've looked at this word that's translated fear. We've looked at it a lot. It was a very common word through the Psalms, and some of you may remember. It's the Hebrew word yare, which is spelled Y-A-R-E. It's not the word for dread or for the cringing kind of. There's a different Hebrew word for that. This is the word for reverential and worshipful awe. One of the best definitions of yare that I found, it means not to be afraid of God, but to be afraid of grieving God because we respect and love him. That's real wisdom. That means I'm going to hate what he hates. I'm going to love what he loves. And that's why the end of verse 28 of chapter 28 says, to depart from evil is understanding. You want to be a wise person? I looked up that word, depart, just in case it was really fat. It's not extremely fat, but it's fairly fat. Let's just say that it's plump. It means to forsake or turn away or cease or remove. So what's wisdom? Wisdom is to have such a reverential awe and worshipful awe for God that you're afraid of grieving him because of your respect and your love for him. And you're willing to remove, turn away from, forsake, depart from evil. When we baptize people in some form or another, and I don't like memorized speeches, I like it to just be real. We ask them, have they put their trust in Jesus? And then we ask them, are you willing to renounce evil? Which is not the same as saying, do you promise you're never going to make a mistake or sin the whole rest of your life? That's not what we're saying. We're saying, are you going at this moment to turn your back on evil? A decisive decision. That's what verse 28 says about understanding. Solomon has so much to say in Proverbs about seeking after and properly valuing wisdom and gaining a heart of understanding. And it's eloquent, and you got a whole book to look at. I think it's interesting. In the midst of all of his pain, in the midst of the false accusations, in the midst of Job's confusion, he can't figure out God's been his best friend. And now God's not even talking to him, and he doesn't understand it. He's had brief glimpses of resolve, let's say. Well, we've had brief glimpses of his resolve. For instance, when he said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. If I could just talk to him, and I came before him and he wiped me out, I'm still putting all my hope and all my trust in him. And if I'm examined by him, I know I'll come forth as gold. Because I've chapter 23, he says, because I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. That's a lot of heavyweight stuff to say about yourself. And it would be arrogant except for the fact that God agreed with him. God was the one who said first, that's what this guy is like. So when Job affirms his integrity, he's not just blowing smoke. He's saying the same thing about himself that God said about him. And I think that's meaningful. That in the midst of all that, Job offers this very poetic soliloquy about wisdom. If you understand that wisdom is more valuable than anything, and you understand that you can't have it without having God, and it's the purpose of your heart to treasure the words of God's mouth more than your own necessary food, then chapter 29 is the description of what a life looks like that thinks that way. And that's why I love chapter 29. I call it the model life. Now, this side of the cross where we're sitting, all we have to do is look at Jesus. I just find it so astonishing that one guy on the face of the earth, in the day that Job lived such a life that he lived. And I think that as it's laid out in sequence, Job talks about the value that the integral part of his life, the fellowship with God, was. Now he's just looking back, reminiscing, saying, "Man, I wish I was back there." He doesn't know that he's going to have another 140 years of that kind of wonderful life. He thinks he's about to die, in horrible pain. But he's wrong about that. But in sequence, starts with the fellowship of God. God blesses him. And as soon as God blesses him, and God blessed him greatly, he started looking for people that he could bless. He started looking for needy people. Now, one of the things that his three friends accused him of, totally falsely, was they say, look, the reason that you are rich, or you were rich before God's judgment fell on you, the reason you were rich is because you cheated people. You ripped off widows, and you took no pity on the poor. That's where you got your riches. And so chapter 29, and that's been said a couple of times in the last 20 or 30 minutes of this debate, the last hour or two maybe of this debate, Job's finally getting around to saying, no, it wasn't like that at all. It was just the opposite of that. So I love this chapter. I look at this chapter. We talked about this last night up in Rockland, and we said, man, is this the way you want to live? We all agreed this is the way we want to live. There's a way to get there. Of course, we have the advantage also of we have the Holy Spirit living in us. We have power given to us. But I think when our value is the same as Job's, where he said, I have not departed from your way, chapter 23, because I've treasured your words more than my necessary food. That's how you get to be a person that lives this way. Let's look at chapter 29. Once again, I think it's an improvement because at least he's not saying, I wish I'd never been born, which he said very early in this debate. One commentator pointed out the fact that there are 50 personal pronouns in here, and he says Job is just way off center. He's just talking about himself too much. And I want to say, if you just take the whole debate and you realize all he's doing is answering the charges against him, he's not really talking about himself. And he's wistfully wishing that his life was the way that it used to be. So we get a little bit of a window into what the life was like that God was bragging about. Oh, verse 2, oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God watched over me. Don't you want to say, Job, he's still watching over you, buddy. Everything's going to change in a very short time. But he's saying, oh, that I were as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, when by his light I walked through the darkness. Two or three chapters of Job's defense, he complains of being lost in darkness and not having the light that he's used to. It's not to say that he was never in confusing dark times before, but he always had God's light. Have you ever gone through a time in your life where God just wasn't answering your prayers right away, or he wasn't speaking to you, or you weren't able to discern what he was up to, and how disorienting that is when you've built your whole entire life on fellowship with him? That's what Job is bemoaning. Verse 4. Oh, that I were just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendship and counsel of God were over my tent, or the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, the New King James Bible said. I want to talk about this for a minute, but I want to read the next verse because they're part of the same statement. Oh, that I were just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendship and counsel of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was still with me, when my children were all around me. I discovered my new favorite Hebrew word. I looked up the word friendly counsel, because it's just kind of a cool phrase, friendly counsel of God. Not something you hear very much in the Old Testament, is it? You hear about the judgment of God and the awesomeness and holiness of God, but the friendly counsel of God. So I looked this word up, and it's my new favorite word. It's not a fun word. It's just what it means. That's so wonderful. The word is the word sod, which is spelled C-O-W-D, transliterated. But listen to what it means. It means friendly conversation amongst very close friends. No, now that's thrilling. But what makes it really fun, if you like the etymology of words, if you like to discover the roots of words and how certain words came into being because of where they came from, the root of this word sod is the word for couch or cushion. It reminds me of that book Monica talks about First We Have Coffee. It's about that schmoozing. You know, find a comfy place, get your French roast or your Earl Grey or whatever, plump yourself all up, plump up those cushions, kick back, and then just spend all day talking to your best buddy. That's what the word means. I'm not exaggerating. In Oriental Middle Eastern culture, it's still a really big deal. When people are going to sign peace treaties with warring tribes, they will come and they'll do that for days. And then they'll get around to talking about the terms. Here's what Job is saying in verses 4 and 5. He said, this was my life. When the sod, that friendly conversation amongst very close friends, was over my tent. That phrase means it enveloped my whole life. It was the atmosphere I lived in. It was the environment I lived in, not just me. The Almighty was with me, and all my children were with me. We were talking about it on the way home last night, and Julia said, that's my dream. My dream is for that to be my family. For my family to be me and Jesus, my kids, the people that I love, all gathered around me, and we're just constantly in that place of intimate, friendly fellowship and conversation. You start to see the enormity of Job's pain when you realize he lost all of that in less than 24 hours. It's gone. Here's an intriguing thing that I was thinking about. I pondered it all day today. In chapter 42, which is not very far away, I like to keep my finger over there for the depressing parts in the middle. I like to just turn to the end and go, wait, this has a happy ending. But in chapter 42, it says, the end of Job's life. God blessed more than the beginning. And then it does this brief little inventory of, you know, the stuff that he got back double over. But it wasn't the stuff that was the blessing of Job's life in his mind. The blessing of Job's life in his mind was the sod. And he got that back too. Just, and of course, my brain really got off on this. Max Lucado has a wonderful quote. I don't forget which book it's in, but I put it on the bulletin board out there. It says, a season of suffering is a small price to pay for a clearer view of God. Isn't that powerful? Have you been through a season of suffering in your life? If you are able to make it through that and respond even remotely appropriately to it, you know stuff about God that you didn't know before then. You know things about his comfort. You have insights into things that you never would have had. That's the only reason God allows it. Is that Romans 8:28 thing. He's working, you've said this many times, Mark, about your cancer. Horrible as that was, you wouldn't trade that experience, would you? Because you have things. They're yours. You didn't read them in a book. See, okay, here's Job. The end of his life, yeah, he gets all the stuff back. He gets more than enough stuff back. But he gets the sod back. What do you suppose him and God have to talk about for the next 140 years? The next time, actually, the next time when God steps on the scene in chapter towards the end here, and Job gets to actually see God, one of the few people in scriptures that ever actually saw God. He said, you know, I've been hearing you with my ears for years, but finally my eyes have seen you. And he was never the same. Even his whole posture is different. He repents even though God doesn't charge him with actually doing anything wrong. It just humbles him. But see, now you think, God, you meanie, why did you spend, 35 whole chapters? By the way, it was only 12 or 13 hours. Why didn't you speak up? God says, well, you know what? We're going to have 140 years in this life to schmooze and talk about it. And then we'll have a couple of billion years to talk about it with him and his kids. So God wasn't in a big hurry. He's never in a big hurry when I'm in a big hurry, because he knows what he's going to do. But as I've been pondering this, it sort of blows me away. By the way, back up in verse 2, there's this little thing you can whiz right through it. But I looked it up, actually, because I don't know Hebrew as well as I know Greek. I look everything up. But he says, oh, that I were as in months past. So how long has this trial lasted? Well, the Hebrew phrase, if you take it literally, just means more than 30 days. If you take it figuratively, which is perfectly legitimate, it's a very short time. It was a horrible trial. I don't want to minimize that. Please don't get me wrong. But it bears in mind the thing I wrote on the little piece of paper I gave to you a while ago, that for a godly person, suffering, all suffering, is temporary. And therefore, all disappointment with God is premature. It seems like it's forever. I just know these 35 chapters in the middle have seemed like they're forever, but that was less than a day. So as horrible and painful as it was, this middle trial of Job. I can't even imagine it. I mean, I've had huge losses and great pain in my life. Nothing I could think with of the enormity and the suddenness that Job dealt with. Perhaps tested in the way that no other human other than Jesus has ever been. But that suffering was a short time compared with the lifetime before and the lifetime afterwards, not even counting eternity. So wrap your brain around that. I love that whole, that cushion word. I just love that. That's the foundation for everything else he's going to say in chapter 29. That's why he was the kind of person he was. Because the Almighty lived in his house and hung out with him and his kids and had coffee with them, and that was pretty much the environment that they lived in. Do you find yourself sighing and saying, oh man, I wish that's possible? Well, it's my job to tell you it is possible. It's just costly, that's all. If it's a priority, it is definitely possible. God wants it. He's the same God. He wants our fellowship. If you could wrap your brain around that, you find yourself saying, well, what in the world, what stinking thing could possibly be more important than that if I can have that? Well, just purpose in your heart that that's what you want, and you'll find a whole bunch of stinking things that can get in the way, because that's the devil's deal. The devil's deal is distraction. It's to get us frittering away our energies and on the stuff that doesn't matter. And then we don't have the time for what's freely offered to us. So I'm getting a lot out of this. I know my friend Bill and I are always talking. He's talking about, the time when it was just the Lord and I. I know what he means. It's not that he doesn't love his family. But there's something about when the fewer the distractions for your brain in your life, when you channel your energy and your thoughts and the desires of your heart towards fellowship with God, it's precious. There's nothing like it. And the more stuff and the more people you add into your life, the less privacy you have, the less time that you have personally. Now, my belief is that God's intention was that you would just wrap your arms around your family and that they would be included in that. That's what I think this word sowed means. And I don't think I'm milking too much out of it when he says in verse 5, the Almighty was still with me and my children were all around me. Part of the package. The cushion word, it's a great word. So what happens if that's the environment that you live in? Well, let's read on and we'll see what that looks like played out in the real world. Verse 6 is obscure. It's poetry. When my steps were bathed with cream and the rock poured out rivers of oil. I looked this up in every commentary that I had, and I got 5 or 6 different explanations, but they all admitted it's obviously figurative language and it has something to do with blessing and productivity in that agrarian society. He's just saying, you know, God had fellowship with us and just pretty much everything we touched was fruitful and productive. The rest of the chapter, Job talks about his relationships with the community that he lived in, where he was considered a counselor, a judge, someone that people came to get fairness. Verse 7, when I went out to the gate by the city, or when I went out by the city gate, is another way to read it, when I took my seat in the open square, the young men saw me and hid, and the aged arose and stood, and the princes refrained from talking, put their hand on their mouth. The voice of nobles was hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouth, which is figurative language for they couldn't, they were speechless. And when the ear heard, it blessed me. When the eye saw, it approved me because. So he's talking about respect from nobles and common people, from old people and young people, when he took his place as a counselor. Do you remember Israel tour people? When we went to Tel Dan and King Wayne sat at the city gate along with the Novak kids, and our tour guide told us that this was the place where disputes were heard. This was the place where people came. The wise men, the counselors, the officials would come and sit out at the gate where everybody was safe. Nobody had to go inside the walls where they could be trapped and imprisoned. It was, we're going to come out to you where you feel safe and safe territory, and you just come and you tell us what your problems are, and we'll make good decisions. That's what this whole scenario is talking about. Job said, when I did that, out of respect, people took appropriate measures to value my counsel because, here's his reputation. By the way, God agrees with him. I always like to throw that in there because it sounds an awful lot like a guy running for office, except instead of another Democratic senator or another Republican senator endorsing him, this is God we're talking about. So carries a little more weight. Once again, all of this is an answer to the accusations of his friends that said, you're a cheat, you rip off poor people, that's how you got rich, and now you're a liar because you won't admit it. And that's why all this bad stuff happened to you. And Job says, oh man, it's not that way at all.